and welcome to another episode of Horror Homeroom Conversations. I'm Elizabeth Irwin.
I'm Gwen Hoffman.
And today we're kicking off our Schools Out series in which we pair one horror film with one non-horror film to create the ultimate summer viewing experience. In this episode, we're queer and we're here with 1999's But I'm a Cheerleader and 2000's Psycho Beach Party. So stay tuned. We're going to kick things off with But I'm a Cheerleader, yes?
Yes.
Awesome.
I think we were both just looking to do something fun, something relaxing, something that we enjoy, and we also wanted to celebrate Gay Pride Month. So happy Pride, everybody.
Woo! So for those of you sad souls who have not yet watched this movie, one, look at your life, look at your choices.
Yes.
Two, here's a little brief overview of it. Megan, a perky cheerleader, is sent away to True Directions, a conversion therapy camp, when it is suspected by her friends and her family that she is, gasp, a lesbian. I think that about sums it up.
Yeah, that is about it. And then the rest of the film is just what unfurls as they're enduring their steps.
I mean, magic unfurls. I love everything about this movie. And when we were talking about doing a non-horror film, this was honestly at the top of my list right out of the gate.
I agree. I think that we both had mentioned that we don't own a ton of DVDs anymore, but this is definitely one that we both own.
Right. I'm down to about 12, and this one features very, very prominently.
Yeah, I can't let go of it.
So what is it about the film that just draws you in and makes you want to repeatedly watch it? Because, I mean, it is from 1999. There have been a lot of great queer films since the 90s, but yet I find myself always returning to this one.
I think it's the type of humor. I really love that it kind of goes all in with the campiness. I love the actors in it. I mean, this is star-studded. If you haven't seen it, again, get out from underneath that rock. Check it out on Google. There's a lot of names in there you're going to recognize. The soundtrack is fantastic. You're going to laugh, and you're just going to have a good time.
That does sum it up.
Yeah.
It really does. I think probably maybe the best way to go about talking about this movie is to go through the characters.
Sure.
Do you think that makes sense?
It does make sense.
So we're going to start with Megan, of course, played by the amazing, the wonderful Natasha Lyonne.
Yeah.
Who, in my eyes, can do no wrong. Let's forget about some of her past indiscretions.
She's don't definitely we all have back. Them, though? Come on.
Maybe not those particular ones, but I have to say, she is so perfectly cast in this role.
Oh, yeah.
And I love the fact that here you have an actual lesbian coming-of-age film with a femme character, because we were talking before we started about how, particularly in the 90s, mm-hmm. every version of a lesbian coming-of-age that was out there primarily tended to do with androgynous or butch characters.
Right.
I think that was overwhelmingly what we were seeing on screen. And so this, to me, was a radical departure.
I agree. And I just love the fact that they make her a cheerleader, because we already know I love films that involve cheerleading.
Yes, we do.
We do. But it was an intentional choice from what I had found, too, just using that cheerleader, because it is kind of your stereotypical American ideal of what feminine is.
Right.
So let's take this cheerleader. And she even says, just like in the title line, but I'm a cheerleader. What do you mean? I can't be a lesbian. I'm a cheerleader. Sure, I am a vegetarian. Sure, I have vaginal motifs on my pillows. Sure, I listen to Melissa Etheridge, but I'm a cheerleader. This can't be real.
But tell the truth, as they were ticking off all the quote-unquote signals.
No.
Really? I was every single one.
No.
And I die to this day.
No, I still don't listen to Melissa Etheridge. No offense, I just don't. I don't think I have one vaginal motif anywhere in my house, let alone where I lay my head at night. I don't know. I sleep on a lamb-shaped pillow, if that matters.
Ew. I get it. That's
right. So no, I don't.
And I just like the fact that they take this quote unquote wholesome girl, and the only thing that people could really say about her is, oh my God, she might be a lesbian. And I love that that becomes the reason that the family and her friends have to have an intervention. Because now, you know, you think about interventions, you think about something like truly horrific, but no, we think you might be one of the gays. So
I have to tell you, like, my little side story about vegetarianism. So I was at work one time, and this was not too long ago, and somebody had been talking about, you know, gay, lesbian, bisexual, whatever. Somehow it comes up at work. And so the one girl turns and looks at me. And you know how you sometimes start to whisper something when it's a certain word? So I'm thinking she's going to say, are you a lesbian? And she goes, are you a vegetarian. I was like, where did that come from? And yes. And then so a couple minutes goes by and then she goes, are you a feminist?
Oh,
and
she I'm was like, feeling you out.
Yes. I'm like, okay. And I go, and let's just get it out of the way. Yeah, I'm a lesbian. Let's just throw it out there. But I just found it quite funny and odd that she paired those things and felt that she had to whisper vegetarian and feminist.
I mean, I don't know if that shows progress or regression, but it shows something that probably we'll have to unpack in the future.
She was much younger than me, too. Like a good 20 years.
There are differences in the generation.
There sure is. There sure is.
We'll go with that. So the thing about Megan, too, that I think is really interesting is that she is an actual cheerleader. And I think it's a good choice because it does sort of underscore that, oh my God, lesbians are everywhere. They're not just the soccer players. They're not just the rugby players.
Yeah.
And we see that a lot in queer films. And that would bring us to Graham, who is her love interest, played by another fantastic actress who I absolutely adore, and that's Clea DuVall. She's amazing. And what I like about Graham is her trajectory, because she starts off at True Directions and she's very contrary. She's like, nothing's wrong with being gay. I have no problem with it. Her father arrives with his new wife and says, listen, you know, you get on board with this program or no college, no home, we're completely cutting you off. And it scares her enough that she does start to at least pretend to be going along with the program. Mm-hmm. And that felt very true to life for me, because there's always, whenever National Coming Out Day comes around, you always see, you know, come out, forget the consequences. And especially for like queer adolescents, there are consequences sometimes, and you have to do what's safe for you. And I like that there was sort of that complexity there for Graham.
Absolutely. I mean, it's easier said than done when you think that it puts college aside for her.
Oh, yeah.
Thinking that you have no home to go to and you're a teenager. And that's a reality. That's even something that came up in that TV series Pose that's in its second season.
Ooh.
So if you guys haven't checked that out, again, sidebar.
Came back last night.
Phenomenal.
So good.
Show. Some of the best developed characters I've ever seen. But yeah, sometimes you can't go home. So there are real, real, real consequences. So I did like that. The only criticism I had of her character is I'm pretty sure she didn't wash her hair once in the whole film.
I can honestly say that I never noticed that.
I noticed some of those weird things.
See, now I feel like I have to go back and look at all the stills. Hold on. No. Like, I have to know. Do you feel like their relationship was rushed? Or do you feel like... That's sort of accurate because we're dealing with teenagers.
I think it was really well done for teenagers, because there's that kind of like the snide comments that might happen when that courtship is happening for younger individuals. Because again, it's kind of like the idea of the little boy pulling the girl's pigtails because he doesn't know how to actually have game, you know. And in this too, she just kind of makes these comments about her being prissy and privileged and, you know, not being there for the right reasons and thinking that she can change and being so she just kind of makes those types of comments and digs. And I think that that leads into their friendship eventually. And I thought that that was pretty accurate and not rushed at all.
The ending to me always stands out because it's sort of that culmination. So many queer films, especially up until that point, it was just a sad ending. Usually somebody died or there was some tragedy. That's the way it was. And the fact that this ends, spoiler alert, but it's a nice ending. And it's sort of an affirming ending.
It is a super good ending.
It is. Like, because your heart just goes, aww.
And I didn't think that I had those strings left in my heart. But that film really kind of plucks them.
It really does. It really does. So those are our two central characters. They enter into conversion therapy with a bunch of other people. We have Hillary and Jan, Mike, Rock, Dolph, and who else did we have? There was one other character. Clayton.
Yeah.
And
we're all stereotypes. Oh, did you say Andre too?
Andre.
Oh,
how could
Andre.
I forget Andre? And they are. They do inhabit. Each character inhabits a particular stereotype.
Absolutely.
But it's so wonderfully done. Because I think the problem is some viewers are going to look at this and they're going to say, that's offensive. And I worry about that, especially for younger viewers, because I think sometimes you see a quote-unquote stereotype and it fosters a reaction from people, particularly on social media. And I hope people watch the whole film to realize that the stereotypes are there for a reason. They're trying to deconstruct
Oh, something, absolutely.
But I think that's gotten lost in some of the reviews that I've read of the film that have been taken throughout the years.
Absolutely.
So you don't have any problem with the stereotypes?
No, I love them. I think they're fantastic because I think that they are so true. They are not necessarily true to what is out there, but the stereotypes themselves ring true.
Right.
So people might be like, oh, they're foreign. As part of the steps, you have to first admit that you're a homosexual. And along the way, you also have to identify your root. And it cracks me
up. It's the
best. Because when Graham says that her mother got married in pants, so did mine. So I joke around and I say that it's because my mother got married in pants. And one of the girls says, well, I'm French. The other one says, oh, all girls boarding school.
Yep.
The other one plays softball. I mean, I love that one. She cracks me up. What was her name? Is that Jan?
I think that was Jan.
Yeah, who plays this super overtly looking butch character who's into every athletic sport that you could be in. I mean, seems like the one that you would pick out of a crowd and be like, mm-hmm, yep, she's one. But no.
Yeah, there's a surprise with her character,
yeah,
for sure.
And then you have the wrestler. So he kind of complements the idea of the cheerleader. Clayton works retail.
Yes, he does.
And then Andre never seems to find his route. But
poor
he
Andre.
Is kind of your stereotypical flamboyant type of individual.
So altogether, they have been sent to this camp. And it is a conversion therapy camp. But I think it's really important to note that it's a conversion therapy camp wherein they're trying to teach these teenagers how to be specifically feminine or specifically masculine, how to inhabit these mm-hmm. traditional roles. It's not conversion therapy the way conversion therapy really exists.
No.
So we're not going to see sort of that seedy underbelly where people are being literally tortured.
Right.
And I think that's important to differentiate because I know I've talked to some other fans of the film who are put off by that. And they're like, well, should it really take place in a, you know, reparative therapy facility if they're not going to show it? And that never, I never understand that because that's the whole point of parody.
Yeah. And I don't think that its specific intent is to necessarily deconstruct the conversion therapy.
Absolutely.
I think it's just to deconstruct stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
It's to problematize. I can't get that one out. Even just the way that homosexuals look at homosexuality.
Right.
It's supposed to increase the conversation and also kind of look at some more conservative right views.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's already doing enough. You can't do it all.
And that does lead us into the conservative character who is in charge of this particular facility.
OMG, I love her.
And she is wonderful.
So Kathy Moriarty.
Who is amazing. And she's in charge of the facility. And she does have a son who is less than a shining example of what her facility can produce. I think that's fair to say.
Rock.
And rock is awesome. And it also bears noting, too, that RuPaul, yes, that RuPaul, mm-hmm. plays a facilitator at the camp and one, I guess, Mary's right-hand man.
Oh, yeah.
To a degree. And there's this wonderful subplot of Rock and Mike just basically turning each other on. And it's so obviously apparent that mm-hmm. they're both super, super gay.
Mm-hmm.
And neither one of them will admit it. And Mary sees that. And I think that for me is the best part of the humor is she keeps trying to corral them into these gender roles. And no matter what she does, no matter how much they might want it, it's just not possible because you can't be something that you're not.
But what I also love, too, is kind of building on what you were just saying, is that no matter who the characters are, you pretty much get this consistent idea that this conversion therapy does not work.
Oh, absolutely.
So it's either you hide it, mm-hmm. you lie, you just do whatever you got to do. But I think that they all seemed to agree that it's not going to work, except for, of course, Mary.
There are two people who exist sort of on the periphery, and they're mm-hmm. ex-people who worked at Mary's facility. And one of them is played by Richard Mall
yes.
from Night Court.
Night Court. Bull.
I love him. And I love them as a couple because he's this like mammoth man and then his partner is this like little tiny guy and they're so kind to one another.
Yeah.
And what they offer is a safe haven in their home for all the kids that get thrown out or flunk Mary's program.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that you hear them talk about, okay, well, what's next? Like, are you going to go to school?
Yeah.
Like, let's find you housing. Like, in a very, very subtle way, showing the importance of having sort of a landing place mm-hmm. for these kids to be able to go to as a step between like a household that might not want them, that they were born into.
And I like, too, that they really kind of don't pressure anybody to come out. They're like, look, we're not telling you what to do.
Right.
We're just making sure that you have a well-rounded education. What you do is what you do. That's up to you. But we just want you to know that there's more out there.
And I think that's an important message. But for me, I mean, as much as I love the humor of the film and I love the message of the film, I just love the way it looks. It is so saturated in color.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous in that it's so pink and it's so blue.
Yes, it is.
And it's just this sort of suburban house of horrors in a way that just looks so perky and so pretty.
Which is terribly contrasted with the parents. Because remember, so anytime that the parents or even some of those characters from the outside world, so even when the cheerleaders and the football players came to do the intervention with Megan, everybody was in brown. So a lot of the outside characters are consistently always in brown, taupe, cream, white, but it's very, very bland.
Yes.
So I think they make a clear attempt to kind of set them against one another and show that maybe that outside world is just a bit drab and a little bit lacking in life and in color, especially for those that were so rigidly judging the kids going to this camp.
What do you think it is about this film that has made it stand up so long? Because if you ever look at like best of lesbian lists, and I do.
Yeah.
No, but it's always there. Yeah. It's always like top 10, top 20. And I wonder what you think it is about this movie that makes it hold up.
I think it's just the humor. Because you know what? A lot of lesbian films, so I'm going to, you know, go just on lesbian films, in my experience, can be quite boring.
Oh.
That's a personal, like, I'm not necessarily somebody that always seeks out homosexual movies, gay, lesbian, bisexual, whatever. Like, I don't always seek it out.
Right.
I tend to fall upon them because they kind of fall into the type of humor I like. So campy, over the top, and you're silly, whatever. So, and that's how I fall into them. So, which often does lead me a little bit more towards some of your, like, you know, Priscilla's.
Oh.
Which I'm sure we'll be talking about shortly.
Oh, we will definitely be talking about that.
So I think that the type of humor in it hit home for me. I felt like it was a better depiction of kind of those high school years.
Mm-hmm.
It was funny. The soundtrack was phenomenal. The actors and actresses, again, they offered a spectrum of characters, too, that everybody could kind of pull from. Because you're right, when we were talking about those 90s lesbian films, a lot of times it was super butchy, and that just wasn't my thing. And I didn't just hang out with other homos, because most of us didn't know that we were out there, you know what I mean, at that age.
Yeah.
So.
I think for me, you touched upon the acting, and to me, that's what sets this apart, because a lot of the movies, especially from the 90s, and speaking just about lesbian films, they were super low budget indie fare.
Yeah.
And you didn't always have the best acting.
No.
And no, I mean, you really did it. And I could name a few, but I won't because I don't want you people to at me on social media. But we all know what films I'm probably thinking about. And
the ones that will not be on our lists later on.
No. And I like the fact that here's this movie that is well acted, it's well produced, it gives a variety of perspectives, and it's just a nice coming of age story where people are happy in the end.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
You deserve to have that. You deserve to have that example.
And it wasn't solely about falling in love. I think that's the other thing is I've never liked romantic films or even just straight romantic comedy films. I don't care if it's gay, straight, whatever. Like, I've just never been a fan of that type because it's not something that has been high on my priority list. You know, I've never felt this need to have somebody on a white horse come and, you know, whisk me off and go and build this family and have these, you know, 2.5 kids with a picket fence. That's never been my reality. I just want to freaking laugh. At the end of the day, I want to get through today. I want to have a good time doing it. And I'll worry about tomorrow. So that's why I think, too, a lot of those other films were just so much more romance.
Mm.
This one was more than that. There was so much more going on besides Megan and Graham.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I do think it's a love story, but I think it's more a love story of like falling in love with yourself and saying, I'm enough as I am. I don't have to fit your preconceived notion of what I should be. And to me, that's the message of the film, and that's what resonates. And that's why I like that moment in the end when it is like storytelling arc-wise. It is a traditional, you know, they had the obstacle and now they've come together and they're literally riding off into the sunset together. Mm-hmm. But it feels really earned because it feels like their relationship might not last, but what they've learned about themselves will. And to me, that's what makes it really resonant and makes it one of those movies that I'm like, okay, I know y'all think I always give old movies, but here, you have to watch this. You have to watch it. Not that 1999 should be that old, but I guess it is now.
Yeah. And here's the other thing. I've totally been in that bar that looks just like the Cocksucker. Like, that was like...
That's every lesbian bar.
Yeah.
From like, the 90s.
That was like every gay bar I went to when I was a kid. I mean, they were just kind of small, dark, a couple people on the floor, very different. But that kind of rung true for me, too.
Yeah. And what really rung true to me, too, was right outside the door where all the garbage is and the people making out, because that's what inevitably would happen. It just really captured, I feel like, a particular moment.
Yeah.
And for me, it really does define the late 90s. And
so there's two other things I want to at least talk about before I forget them, because I've got a brain like a seagull lately. No offense to seagulls, if there's any out there listening. So first, I want to know if you had any super fangirl moments in this film that you just stood out to you that you're like, yes, I love this part, and I'll give you mine.
Ooh, okay.
And then I want to know if there's any one character that either resonated with you, you identified with, or just is your favorite, because it is.
Oh.
So I can go first while you're thinking.
Yeah, because that's a tricky one.
So for me, I'm going to start out with those moments that I was like, this is why I love this movie,
okay.
Right? So first of all, let's kind of go back to Kathy Moriarty. I told you when we were talking on the phone prior to this, I was like, I went all Soap Dish.
Yes!
Because Kathy Moriarty was in the film Soap Dish. That's mm-hmm. another one that totally probably been like swept under the rug by most people's
it's
brains.
So funny.
But it is so funny. Yeah. And in that too, she plays a very gender-bending character.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great comedy film. So when I see her, I think of that and I geek out. Then of course I've got Minx Stole. Everybody knows I love my John Waters films.
I love it.
And she's basically in every single John Waters films. And then when she's in this film and she starts dropping some curse words, I go immediately to that scene from Serial Mom when she's talking, they're having the prank phone call.
Yes.
Like 212, fuck you, you cocksucker, pussy willows, like you name it. And I'm just laughing as she's sitting in this living room cursing in But I'm a Cheerleader.
Yes.
Flashing back to Serial Mom, and I'm just cracking up because they just felt very familiar.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now, did you have any of those fangirl moments before we move on to favorite characters, too?
I did have a fangirl moment, and it was Kathy Moriarty.
Yes.
Because ultimately, I feel like this movie hinges on her in a way.
Yeah.
Because you can't have the head of this facility be just completely awful. Like, there has to be some humor to it. And for me, I love sort of the implied innuendo that maybe she has her own latent issues that she's trying to block. But I actually wrote it in my notes because I love this line every single time is when she looks out the window and she sees her son who is wearing like the short denims and, you know, has the muscle shirt on and is waving all of the lawn equipment around in what can only be defined as a very provocative manner.
Yeah.
And he takes out a drink and he starts to drink it and he's sipping it like the little pinkies up. And she says to him, no more sipping. Chug it like a man. Uh-huh. And I was like, I don't know why, but every time she says that line, I bust out laughing because there's so much rage there, but there's also so much familiarity because how many times are you told as you're growing up, do something like act like a lady.
Yeah.
Or, you know, be this way. What are you doing? You're bringing shame upon the family by being you. And it just feels so true.
That scene actually makes me think to later on to the final step where they have to have simulated sex. And then Kathy Moriarty is like in her son's ear to
blow a load.
And she's just like, forget about foreplay. Foreplay's for sissies. Just get in and get out. Like,
and she literally says, blow your load. And I'm like, that's your son. I can't.
Yeah.
It's too, I know, it's so cringeworthy, but you're also laughing.
Yes.
I love every, and you have to visualize the moment because they're in these sort of nude body
Adam
suits.
And Eve kind of.
Yes,
fig
and they
leaves.
Have like fig leaves for their private parts. And it's just, it's amazing. Like whoever thought through these costumes really deserved an Academy Award because they just nailed it. Like, you literally see the person come onto the screen, and the spectacle alone will already have you start laughing.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. And I also want to add, too, in those fangirl moments, I think that that song, Glass Vase Cello Case, it's by Tattletale, that they play when Megan and Graham just really start to get together. First of all, it is one of the best songs I've ever heard in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, I think it is probably by far one of the best placed songs in any film I've seen.
I agree.
Like, that just makes that moment. And I would forever imagine that scene when I hear that song and vice versa. I think that that's just a damn good song.
It is a damn good song. Yeah. And I like the way that they do use like different parts of it to build the relationship. And so that when the ending happens, oh, the music, it's so perfect. It literally is just so perfect. It gives me chills. I love it.
So then anybody you identify with or that you just kind of is a favorite, either or, whatever.
Anyone I identify with. I wouldn't say I identify with any of the characters specifically, but probably Megan, because I literally laugh as they're sitting there doing the intervention and they're like, vegetarian, check. Queer iconography, check. They open up the locker and there's pictures of women instead of men, and like, double check. And just her dawning realization of, oh, wait, I thought everybody had those thoughts. It never would have dawned on me that I was gay unless somebody told me. And I think especially like where I grew up, and like I grew up in the South, it's very conservative, definitely like more evangelical religious background. It never would have dawned on me.
Yeah.
And it's just funny watching them check off those things and being like, I didn't have any vulvas on my pillow, but I definitely had a lot of flowers happening in my...
Vulva?
Well, that's what you see. It sounds like on her pillowcase. But I mean, you definitely have the flowers. And it's just funny because I look at each one and I'm like, oh my God, you got to be kidding me. Like, nobody else realized this.
As you're talking about vulvas, I'm now thinking about this story I heard on the radio this morning because they had the annual naked bike ride, bike race in Louisiana.
I feel you want to participate in that.
Well, and then they came to find out that people were using the bike share bike for their naked bike ride. Like, ew, have some scent. Like, but okay, sidebar. I think I just made Liz spit something out.
I took the wrong time to take a drink of water. Why would you do that?
Right? That's so rude.
Oh.
Like, even I have a line in the sand.
I mean, you know how I am with germs. I'm going to be bringing wet wipes everywhere.
I'm okay with germs, but don't put your vulva on my bike seat. So now, as far as, I would love to say I was closer to a Graham.
Yeah.
Because I am kind of that bitter, sarcastic, kind of in-your-face type of a personality. I don't know if you've noticed. But in all reality, I think I'd actually probably be closer to a Dolph.
Oh, you are definitely Dolph.
Yeah.
Yes, that rings true to me.
Because you know what, too? Like, he wasn't miserable in his life. And I think that sometimes Graham just kind of sits in her misery, even though she's proud of who she is. And then she did have to kind of suck more up than I ever had to. Like, I didn't have to. I had phenomenal parents. I grew up in between two major cities, Philadelphia and New York. So I had access to all kinds of clubs, all kinds of experiences, all kinds of people. So I was very, very blessed. So yeah, I think with Dolph, you know, I was just kind of, I was that guy. And I normally do identify with the gay guys, I think. That's just me. And that's what I hung out with. I mean,
yeah. I have to think about that.
But as far as a favorite?
Oh, a favorite character? I enjoy all of them. To me, this is really a movie that hinges upon the whole instead of individual performances.
Yeah.
Because I feel like you can't have one without the other. I mean, you have the one girl in bed zapping herself in like what is suggested as BDSM.
Oh, I can't.
Amazing. She's like, I'm just fixing myself. And then you hear like the moaning and the zit and the moaning and the zit. And I'm like, oh my God. But it's so well done.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, all the characters definitely fulfill a particular niche, I guess we would say.
So what about any larger themes? Because I think that some of the themes that are in this are going to feed into some of the themes later on, too, like such as those rigid gender stereotypes.
Oh, absolutely.
So as part of your steps, you had to learn how to act your gender. And this is before we had 97 different types of ways to identify. So it was just, they had the women down on their hands and knees learning how to scrub a floor.
Absolutely.
Change a diaper. I don't know how that's ever hard for any gender, but okay. They had, besides vacuuming, washing dishes. The men were fixing cars.
Yes.
Learning how to throw footballs. So it was very, very, very binary.
Yes. But I liked how they showed that each one of those binary activities usually came with an undercurrent of homoeroticism. So, for example, when RuPaul is trying to teach these young men how to fix a car, he's literally under the car and his pelvis keeps going up.
Thrusting.
Like, up. Stick it. Stick it. And you can literally see on the faces of these boys, like, they're just getting more and more turned on. Yeah. And then they look at each other and they're like, guilty.
Yeah. And then you have Kathy Moriarty doing the same thing when she's vacuuming. She's going in and yes. out. And in and out and deeper. And I'm like, oh, no, nope.
But it just, I love that it really just takes those little traditional roles and just like blows them apart. It says, this is all so ridiculous. And watching them play out, you realize how ridiculous they are. And yet they still persist.
Yeah.
I mean, I think in terms of broader themes as well, I guess just finding the comedy in things that are hard to talk about for people.
Yeah.
And I don't know that a lot of queer comedy is always successful because I feel like sometimes it gets too in the weeds with things and it's too afraid to actually say, it's okay to laugh at ourselves.
Yeah.
It's okay to laugh at the way other people view us and also how we view ourselves. And I think that's what this film gets right. I think people who reviewed it, I think it really is dependent upon your own experiences. I feel like queer reviewers of this film might feel a different way than heterosexual reviewers, only in that if you've had those experiences or had a familiarity with those experiences, you probably understand the intricacies a little bit better. Mm-hmm. So you might be able to understand where the humor's coming from a little better. And that's not to say that, you know, you have to be gay in order to review a gay film.
No, I agree.
But it is saying that when you have that lived experience, you do pick up on certain things that maybe other people without those shared experiences will miss. And if you're able to pick up on them, you're probably able to make fun of them as well.
Yeah. It's like being on the inside.
Yeah. And I actually, before we started, I was talking to you about a review that I read from 2000. Okay. So we're talking 19 years ago. And this review is by Stephanie Zacharak. And it appeared in Salon on July 7th, 2000. And it's not a positive review of the film. She didn't care for it, which is completely valid. But she did write something that I thought was interesting given our current political climate. And so she writes, quote, "Worse yet, the movie is predicated on the embarrassingly retrograde view that most straight people view gay men and lesbians as aberrant. Of course, those prejudices still exist and often in subterranean, dangerous forms. But we also live in a world where, out of genuinely good motives or overtly political ones, people are anxious to prove how tolerant they are. Average, reasonable people don't tend to believe that people can change their sexual orientation. That's mostly the province of religious extremist right-wingers." And she goes on and makes the case. And I understand why she's writing this. Let's say that was the case in 2000. I would argue that was not the case in 2000. But let's just say, hypothetically, it was. What does it mean that we now have an administration that's rolling back rights? That we literally have a vice president who is evangelical and feels like conversion therapy is an option, which is something he supported.
Looking at the film when it was released, and now too, I don't care when you watch the film, I don't think at any point it's making these implications or that it aims to say that the larger audience thinks that we can be changed or that we think that you're bad people because y'all view us this way. No, it's just a fun story that kind of talks about, you know, gender, sexuality, and stereotypes.
Well, it's interesting. I'll go on with what she wrote because that actually probably does tie into what you were saying. She wrote, quote, "There are plenty of battles that still need to be fought, but Babbitt, seemingly stubbornly nostalgic for the bad old days when the lines between camps were more starkly drawn, when blue really was for boys and pink was for girls. In this day and age, you need a few more complex teriyaki colors to get the full picture." And I guess what I would say to that is if you go into a toy store, what do you say?
I was just going to say that. So, you know what? I think that they still are. So I was thinking about parenting styles, too.
Absolutely.
You know, you have your 2-year-old boy fall down on a playground. You're like, get up, shake it off.
Mm-hmm.
Your 2-year-old girl falls down and hurts herself on the playground. Sometimes it's just like, oh, come here. You know, come on, mommy.
You see that all the time.
And you still get people saying, you know, men don't cry in public. And even if they're not saying it outwardly, like, you still don't see a lot of men that just will break down and cry. So I feel like there are still some pretty rigid stereotypes in a lot of places that I'm guilty of having too.
Right.
Absolutely.
But do you think, because she wrote this in 2000, so right when around when the film came out, do you think we've regressed or do you think it's always been that way?
I feel like it's kind of always been there. I feel like it just fluctuates in percentage.
Mm.
But I have to say, say that it's got to be, even though I know that we've got some super right righties and then we've got our super left lefties, I think about it in terms of all of the youth that I see come out at ages that we never would have imagined.
Right.
I see youth being able to say, I don't feel right in this body at an extremely young age and actually be able to start, you know, hormone replacement therapy.
Taken seriously. Yeah.
It's absolutely taken seriously. I see a presidential candidate who is, you know, a homosexual man running for office.
Right.
Like a real candidate, too. So I have to say that the climate is definitely better now. I think you just have a few more visible outliers that are super, super maybe right, but I feel like it's still better.
I feel like it's improving, too. And I think it's very easy to get into the mindset of everything's blowing apart because it does feel like that on some days. But I think, yes, you can still be legally fired for being gay in multiple states. You can legally lose housing for being gay in multiple states still. Being LGBTQ plus is not a protected class.
Correct.
So there are still a huge amount of issues that need to be fought.
Yeah.
But I feel like, I have to feel like the tide is changing, at least in terms of people knowing someone. It's so much more difficult to hate someone if you know the person.
Yeah.
So instead of it being like, I hate lesbians, well, now you have to say, I hate Gwen.
Yeah.
Or I hate Liz. And I think that becomes a much more difficult conversation for some people, not everyone.
Yeah.
But I think for some people, that has helped change the conversation, the mentality. Because I look at especially elderly people now that I know and who I've seen evolve on this front. And I never would have expected it. And I think it comes from having the conversations and being visible, if it's safe for you to be visible.
Right.
But I do worry. I do feel like we're in a very particular time. It worries me that people take for granted
some
of the benefits that have been hard won. And, you know, when you go to protests or you go to ACT UP meetings, you're seeing young people, but you're not seeing the volume that I would expect.
Right.
And I know their modes of communication are different, and there is power on being on YouTube, or there's power through social media. But if that's all you're doing, it does concern me that things are going to get rolled back, especially when you look at the makeup of the Supreme Court right now.
Right.
So I don't know. I think we're in a scary time.
I agree. I mean, you can never get too comfortable.
Yeah.
Because then things will disappear. But at least I'm not seeing as many stories like Matthew Shepard's and Brandon Tina's. And not to say it doesn't happen. Like, I know it still happens.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But I'm hopeful that people don't have to be so much in fear for their life.
Right.
As they might have back then.
Yeah.
So I'm not happy. No.
I know. That took a turn. But I mean, that's part of it, though, honestly.
Well, I guess that's part of the horror of that, though.
It is.
Not for nothing.
Which leads us into our actual horror film.
Yes.
Yes. So Psycho Beach Party.
Yeah.
It is everything and more.
Oh, it sure is.
I'm always amazed at people who haven't seen this one, though, because I feel like in terms of horror comedies,
it's pretty visible.
I would think so, but I usually bring it up and people are like, I've never seen it. And of course, I'm like, well, I have the DVD. Let me run and get it for you because hello. So for those of you not in the know, Psycho Beach Party is a send-up of beach movies and slasher films. And it's a really difficult movie to explain, but the essential story is that we are at 1962 Malibu Beach and there is a killer on the loose, but all Florence, aka Chiclet, wants to do is learn how to surf. And this is another example of a film that is so perfectly cast.
Yeah.
Lauren Ambrose, who a lot of people are going to know from 6 Feet Under, but they should know her from far more, including this movie. She's the one who plays Florence, aka Chiclet. And I think she is just the perfect combination of utterly sweet and fiery because as you discover, Florence has some shades of gray to her. I think that's fair to say. I don't want to spoil anything.
So she's your Gidget-like character. She's kind of your main character.
Yes. Yeah. I actually was rewatching this for the podcast and my grandmother was in the room and she's like, oh, it's Gidget. And then she quit. Oh, it's not Gidget.
No, Graham. It's not. But she kind of right away with wanting to surf too. That feeds right into some of these gender stereotypes too because she's really trying to run up to all these guys that are like huge surfers in the area out west. That's what they're known for. So I imagine like you're back to the beach, the big kahuna kind of thing.
Yes.
And she just wants to be a part of that. And they're like, girls can't surf. And what kind of guy would I be if I taught a girl to surf? I wouldn't amount to anything.
And the main ringleader of that particular viewpoint is named Starcat. And he is played by Nicholas Brendon.
Isn't that fantastic?
Yeah, so from Buffy fame. You're going to notice him right away. And, oh, he's just, you just want to smack that face. Because he's like, girls can't do that. What are you talking about? And, of course, she continues on with her perkiness like, gosh, golly, guys.
Gee whiz.
I can. Let me try, please.
What, are you scared?
Oh, it's so fantastic. Whoever wrote this script just nailed the lingo of the beach movies.
It reminds me of, like, Frenchie from Greece or something.
Absolutely. I mean, they must have watched nonstop, like, Frankie and Annette movies. That's all I could think of.
Yeah.
But we should actually backtrack, though, because the beginning of the movie is one of my favorite parts. So it opens, and it's at a drive-in, there's a movie playing, and it's your standard B-creature feature movie that you would see at a drive-in. And I want to see that movie that they were playing, because it opens up, and you see a woman, and she's behind a door, and all you could see is, like, a close-up of her face. And the man who's in love with her arrives and says, I only ever see you behind this door. I want to see all of you. And he flings open the door, and she's got, you know, two monster heads on either side of her. And she's like, no. And then she suddenly becomes like the 6-foot Amazon woman, and she's crushing things. And it's just a delight on every front. But it brought me back to the days of the drive-in.
Yeah.
Do you still go?
Oh, I still go. I go every single summer. And again, I've been so blessed to grow up in an area that we had like 3 drive-ins in any direction. So I can get to a drive-in in a half hour in any which way. And I should also note that the very first time I ever saw Beetlejuice, one of my favorite films, was at a drive-in theater in Arizona.
Oh, there you go.
Yes. So I have a fondness for especially movie marathons. And sneaking in snacks.
So what makes the drive-in movie experience for you? Because there is, at least in this movie, there's a really nostalgic quality to it.
Yeah.
And does that appeal to you? Was it the reason you still go?
I love that you get more than one movie. So I enjoy that. A lot of the drive-ins around here, too, will do a horror weekend or like a horror marathon.
Yes.
So you might get rapid-fire horror films, which I really, really love. And there is something different about watching a horror film specifically in a drive-in because you have all this empty space right outside your door. And especially in those original days, you had to have either the top down on your car or the window open because that radio would sit on your car hook there.
Yeah.
So there's this idea that somebody could reach into your car at that time. And then if you did have to go to the bathroom, you had to walk out into the dark and kind of traverse all of that.
Yeah.
So I think that that's part of it because I pretty much always watched horror films in the drive-in.
Yeah, the first time I saw Jaws was at the drive-in. I was a real little kid, and I had on, like, my little feety pajamas, and I was sitting on the hood, and I crawled into the back seat, and I was like, nope. We're done. We're done here. We're good. But the movie opens, and the first murder takes place at the drive-in. Mm-hmm. A young girl is making out with her guy. He goes off to use the bathroom.
That's right.
And she's our first victim.
Mm-hmm.
And then we move to the beach, and that's when we first encounter Florence, who's really, well, second time we encounter Florence. And, oh, that brings me back to one other part about the movie that I was dying laughing at. Do you know what I'm talking about? Okay. So the first time we actually see Florence, she's with her friend Berndine. And she, Berndine, to me, how do I put this nicely? Man, Berndine had our number. Okay. So she's sitting in the car and she's watching the movie with Florence. And Florence is like, gosh, golly, this is such a great movie. And Berndine's like, well, the subtextual element that I find most interesting is how it deals with feminism and agency. And I thought, oh my God, is that who we are? I think that's exactly who we are.
I'm not Berndine.
We're both Berndine.
No.
I'm happy to be Berndine because Berndine's smart.
I'm Bettina Barnes.
Oh, Lord. Yeah, we're going to get to Bettina Barnes. But that cracked me up because I thought, oh, if that doesn't, like, sum up what we do in a nutshell.
Yeah.
I don't know. I found it chuckle-worthy. Anywho, so we next move to the beach, and that's where you start to see Florence say, you know, I really want to surf. I want to surf so bad. And since the guys won't help her, she goes to Kanaka, who's sort of like the big, awesome surf god. And he is played by Thomas Gibson.
What I love. I love that. Because all I think about is Criminal Minds.
See, all I think about is Dharma and Greg.
No, he's so boring in Dharma and Greg.
But that's what makes who he is in this movie so much better.
I agree. But he is still kind of dry as Hodge in Criminal Minds,
too. Oh, definitely, definitely.
But I think, like, after all these years of watching Criminal Minds, and sometimes I just put that on in the background to fall asleep, too, so it's very much in the forefront
that's
of my
so
brain.
Messed up.
Yeah, there's got to be, like, screaming in the background that just soothes my amygdala. I don't know. But, yeah, and I was like, oh, that's right. He's in this.
Yes. Oh, he is in this to win it.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess I will spoil a little bit of it. So she goes to him and she's like, hey, I really, really want to learn how to surf.
Yeah.
And he's like, listen, kid, get out of my hut.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't have time for this. And that's our first clue that she might be suffering from additional personalities.
Yeah. What do they call it? Like a split personality or a psychotic break or something?
They have this whole thing. But her other side is basically a dominatrix. And that's where we get our first clue that perhaps, just perhaps, Kanaka likes to be a submissive. And that cracked me up because down the line, you're going to get a lot of sight gags with him, especially what he's wearing under his clothes. And it's just so well-timed and well-placed. These characters are absolutely bonkers.
Yeah.
And we find out that one of the group of guys that were like, hey, no, we're not going to teach you how to surf, suffers from the heartbreak of psoriasis. And lo and behold,
woe is me.
We find his hand, his liver, I believe.
A couple pieces of him.
And maybe a foot or two.
Niblets.
On his beach.
Morsels.
So he's our second victim.
Yeah.
So we have two people who are notable for physical attributes.
And kind of back to some of our leads, some very gender bending as well as sexuality bending characters. So we're just going to keep that in the forefront of your brain.
Yes. Well, we could talk about those because two of the other surfers are Provolone.
I love Provolone.
And Yo-Yo.
Hey, Provolone.
And your first indication that maybe, just maybe, there's something brewing there is they can't stop wrestling one another.
And squirting oil on each other.
Like, well, you have to get lubed up.
Yeah, I love how somebody just starts squirting oil on them as they're rolling around in the sand. I mean, to each their own, but you're going to get a lot of sand stuck to you.
But I like it. The oil's added and it's becoming more and more clear that this is not just about wrestling, that all the other dudes who are surrounding him are like, that's enough, guys.
But it takes them a minute.
It totally takes them a minute.
They're just like, all right, you can stop wrestling now.
No. You really can stop wrestling.
And they're super masculine guys.
Yes.
Like, you have this guy that's your stereotypical kind of a Italian guy. Mm-hmm. That's your Provolone. And then the other guy's just a very masculine kind of wrestler build. And I love that about them.
And they're on the beach, and they encounter another one of our characters, and that is a Miss Bettina Barnes.
Yes.
And we find out that Bettina Barnes is actually the actress who was starring in the movie that they were watching in the drive-in when the film first opens.
Yeah.
And she's there because she wants to force the production company's hand to give her better scripts.
And she wants to direct and film and be able to have, like, more of a credit in the films.
But she comes across as she's very breathy and very Marilyn Monroe-esque.
Wait, what is she?
Very breathy.
Guys, make that your ringtone.
Do not do that. But that's her voice.
Yeah.
I mean, she really dials all in on that Marilyn Monroe stereotype.
Yeah.
But you really figure out pretty quickly that there's more to her than meets the eye.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I love about her is when they're in her house for the sleepover, that Yo-Yo and Provolone sort of make their way into her closet, and suddenly they start trying on, like, all her negligees
and stuff.
And she comes in and she's just like, yeah, that's not a good color for you. And she pulls out a different peignoir and puts them in it. And it's like, oh my God, you haven't even seen my shoes yet. And you can tell that they're freaked out because she's not freaked out.
Yeah. But I also love the layers of her too, because you would easily just look at her and dismiss her as the ditzy blonde.
Easily.
Like the object of, you know, affection for a lot of the guys. They all stare at her from afar and talk about that hot babe up the hill and soda, soda, soda.
Yeah.
Then you have when she meets Berdine. And Berdine is like, oh my goodness, you're this actress. And Berdine goes on this film geek rant about
genius.
How fantastic that Bettina is, how she was like a feminist icon and she doesn't get enough credit. And she starts talking about these layers of Bettina. Mm-hmm. And then Bettina goes, you know what? That's what I've been trying to argue with my studio too. Why don't you come and work with me? And you see that she's not this just ditz that you can write off. Because she picked kind of Bettina over everybody else.
Yes.
And even, too, when she has options to kind of become frisky with some of the really good-looking guys, she was just like, no, you know what?
Although she was potentially on her way for a little rendezvous with our third victim, who we find out has only one testicle. Which, to me, begged the question, if the murderer was trying to target people that they felt didn't...
Were different.
Yeah, felt were different. How did he know there was only one testicle?
That's a good question. That's not where I thought you were going with that statement. Completely not.
Where did you think I was going?
I thought you were going to point out the obvious, that if you're trying to remove society from people that are different, yo, look at these people that you left behind. They're some of the most beautifully different. So I think it does, you know, kind of comment to the idea that difference is so subjective.
Absolutely.
Which I love about that.
So another character we should probably introduce is you can't have murders without somebody to investigate the murders.
I love these guys.
Which brings me to Captain Monica Stark. And here's the thing about Captain Monica Stark. She's played by Charles Boosh. We're dealing with a character... That we're dealing with an actor who is a male playing a female character. And I think that's sort of the joke.
Yes.
But what I love about the film is the way there's no nudity shown in this film except
for her. Yeah.
And she's going to town because you find out that she had this little tryst in her background with Kanaka.
Mm-hmm.
And she is going to town with Kanaka.
Mm-hmm.
And you just see boobs flying every which way. I'm shocked somebody didn't get hit in the head. Honestly. But I like that that's where you got your nudity from.
Yes.
And I just love that character so much because she's very ballsy.
Yeah.
She's very in control. She tells Kanaka, no, I don't want to be home with raising some kids. I'm taking my detective's test. And, you know, I have goals. I have ambitions.
Yeah.
And she's unapologetic about it, which I love.
Yeah, and she talks about how it's harder for a woman on the police force to be able to move up, and she's got things she's going to want to do. And interestingly enough, you know, I never really thought about it till now, but it's like I didn't sit there and stare at the film as if she was a male actor playing a female actress.
No.
Like, I literally just continued to watch the film.
Absolutely.
Every single time, just like she's the female cop.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I would be willing to bet that a broader audience is able to do that too. Because the plot is just so well played that I don't think you get hung up on it. And I don't think it's an important part of the plot.
Oh, it's not. No, not at all. I feel like her introduction into the film is supposed to be like a jarring, like, hey, wait a minute. Because you're dealing with a killer who is looking for like...
Different.
Quote unquote, you know, different people. And I feel like all of these characters in their own way are constructed to be different.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the killer's going after certain people, but really he could go after, or she could go after any of these characters because they're all different in their own way because everybody's different. And that's kind of the point.
I also did love the part where Monica Stark was sitting there and she had finally started to realize, okay, the people that are getting killed are people that have something hidden about themselves or something, you know, different about themselves. And she's sitting there talking to Provolone and what was it, Yo-Yo? Is that his name?
Yep.
And she's like, so guys, I'm just letting you two know that people that are getting killed have something different or hidden about themselves.
Yes.
Are you sure you don't have anything different or hidden about yourself? And the two guys are like, nah, what are you talking about? I don't know. Hey, you know? And I just love that pairing of her asking them, kind of being like, come on, guys, fess up. Like, we all know.
Yeah. I mean, it as a queer film, it's so good.
And I love that her partner, what is her name, Cookie or something
Cookie,
like that,
yeah,
is such a butchy woman. Even like they sit down on the Adirondack chairs and she's got her legs spread and she's just so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but it really does underscore, like, from all the characters, like, these binary notions are so ridiculous.
Yeah.
And they're just ways to categorize people that really don't mean anything.
Mm-mm.
Except what we've culturally come to assume means something, I guess. But there are two characters.
Uh-oh.
Two of my favorite characters that we would be very remiss in not discussing. And that would be Marvel Ann, played by Amy Adams, and Rhonda, played by Kathleen Robertson. So Marvel Ann is sort of the prototypical popular girl. And, you know, she is neither here nor there. Her whole focus is to sort of encapsulate and reflect that female feminine that is traditionally known. So she's on the beach when Florence is saying, hey, I want to learn how to do all the cool things that you guys are doing. And she's like, no, you don't. Come save me in the water. And she's got her little itty bitty bikini on. And, you know, she's got her boobs pushed up almost to her chin. And of course, the boys go running in after her. And there's a fabulous dance-off sequence that has to be seen to be believed. But I like the fact that they do have that sort of overtly feminine character.
Yeah.
To show how silly it is. Because, again, going into the idea that these binary categories, they're outdated.
Well, and she's the love interest of what? Starcat?
Initially, yes.
Initially.
Yes.
Yes. So that's your typical kind of heteronormative pairing. You would have that kind of all-star surfer guy who looks great in his bathing suit.
Yeah.
He's, you know, all-star surfer. And then you've got her, you're stereotypically feminine. So everybody just kind of assumes, oh, yeah, you want to be with Marvel Ann.
Right. But the thing about Starcat, too, is that he's also studying psychology
in college.
So he can diagnose anybody.
Absolutely.
Not well, but he can try. And I like that there's that element to his character. But my favorite character is probably Rhonda. And Rhonda is played by Kathleen Robertson, which I mentioned. And she's in a wheelchair, and she goes up to all of the characters. And at first you think she's just this lovely girl because she starts off so polite, and then every single conversation she has takes this turn.
She just drops the mic.
She digs that knife in and then drops the mic and then leaves. And she actually becomes our fourth victim. And the visual.
Oh, God, it's good.
The visual of her head spinning on the wheel because she's been decapitated. It's insanity.
Yeah.
Like, every aspect of this movie is insane.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that because everything's insane, it sort of feels normal after a while.
And the humor is still so campy, which
yes.
is great. And I'm glad you mentioned her because I would have forgotten to even mention her. But she definitely, by far, has some of the best one-liners.
Yeah. Like, she's I thought her death was the best.
Yes. She's very, very biting.
And again, I appreciate that.
Kind of toys with the idea of, you know, what you think is your all-star, you know, most popular girl in your high school. You probably wouldn't pick the girl in the wheelchair to be your stereotypical. So
I just really do like the way it deconstructs absolutely every single trope that you see in movies and just says, well, let's take a second look at that and let's find the humor there. And I think it does pair really well with But I'm a Cheerleader because visually, it's that same sensory experience. You have all the rich, vivid colors.
Mm-hmm.
You just have
great music.
Great music. And the movie just has a vibe about it.
Yeah.
And it's just fun.
Yeah.
And I like that you have all of this queer subtext, both overt and, you know, more subtextual happening. And it just gels in with the heteronormativity that's happening. And it gels in with, like, the issues of psychology that's happening. And you have, like, all of these variant issues, but it doesn't feel like an issue movie. Like, oh, this is a gay movie.
I agree with you. 100%.
It's just a movie where there's some really cool deconstruction of binaries and things happening.
And I think that's what makes them pair so well is just those deconstructions of those binaries, whether it's sexuality, whether it's popularity, whether it's, you know, class, whatever.
Yeah.
I think they just do it in a way that complements one another. And I'm glad we got to do them both because I selfishly love them both.
I adore both of these movies. And if you haven't seen them, I really highly recommend it.
Yeah.
I have any more comments on Psycho Beach Party?
I don't think so. I think we got to some of our like fangirl moments. We got to some of our favorites. We got to the larger themes. So yeah, I feel good about this.
I feel good about this too. So before we end, I definitely do want to give a shout out to Gailey Dreadful on Twitter. He's doing something really amazing this month in celebration of Pride. Every day on his website, there's going to be a new piece of original writing by a queer author, and it's all to try and raise a lot of money for the Trevor Project, which helps support at-risk LGBTQ+ youth. And I did write something for it on the Twilight Zone, which you should check out if you're into that sort of thing. But honestly, there is something for everyone, and I love that he's doing that. And if you could support it in any way, that would be fantastic. But I guess that's it for us tonight. I know we're missing Dawn. So
yes, we're missing Dawn. We miss you. I hope we didn't say anything that overtly offends you and once it makes you want to distance yourself from us.
We really, really tried to be good.
I know. I think we did a good job. So,
here we go.
Truth gun to your head. If you had to pick one of these films to watch, which one would you do?
You can't ask me
just
that.
Just did.
Psycho Beach Party.
No! Not
yes,
even.
What? It can't be a wrong answer. It's my choice. You pick, but I'm a cheerleader.
Oh, absolutely. Hands down.
Interesting. You know, I probably would have if I was just remembering Psycho Beach Party, but I literally just watched it this morning and no, man.
I do love Psycho Beach Party, but again, if I could only choose one,
yeah,
but I'm a cheerleader because I think it's just a whole body experience.
See, for me, that's Psycho Beach Party. Psycho Beach Party really taps into my desire to always be on the beach with like a coconut in my hand and living in a hut. Like that's what it taps into for me. And
oh, see, no, I'd be up in the mountains with the rocky shores.
And I do watch the Gidget movies, like non-ironically.
Not shocking me. So either which way, guys, I think that you should watch both of them. Step outside of yourself if it's something you wouldn't have picked up before. Really check them both out.
Yeah.
They're fantastic films. And I hope you enjoyed us kind of doing something a little bit different because we sure had a good time.
Yeah. And do us a favor and follow us on all things Horror Homeroom on the social medias. And until then, we will talk to you later.
Bye.